Hi, my name is Dave. I'm an alcoholic. My watch and my glasses, when I got to AA, I didn't have either. I'd have been happy with just the watch. For those people that are new tonight, the first thing that I want to tell you is that anything that I've got to say has to do with what happened to me and what it was like and what it's like now. And everything that I know about the disease of alcoholism I learned after I got here. And particularly if you're new here tonight, I want to tell you about a story that happened in the car tonight on the way over here. My wife Victoria and Jerry and I were driving over here, and we've been married about 4 years, so Victoria is not familiar with a lot of the background. And Jerry was telling Victoria about a little bit about how it used to be. And he was telling her about this room that I lived in Balboa Island. My kids called it the cell. It was a little bit longer than the bed, and at the foot of the bed was a toilet, and under the bed was everything that I owned. And I had gone through bankruptcy, and I had killed a 20-year-old young man in an accident, and I didn't have any money, and I didn't have a job, and everything was in terrible, terrible shape. And if you're new here tonight, I'm sure you're thinking that after that I came to AA, but that's not what happened. As Jerry told Victoria, at that time I was 11 years sober. And so everything I've learned about Alcoholics Anonymous was really summed up in the first night that I got to AA, when I was told that the only thing that I could count on is that I didn't have to drink. There were no other guarantees. And there are no other guarantees. Today, my life couldn't be any better. I was talking to my friend Joe before the meeting about how both of our lives have improved, particularly in the last 4 years, and talking about how great it is. And let's say that something happened, and let's say that I lost what I had and lost my family, and let's say that everything disappeared. And then let's say that I went out and got drunk. Well, I'm sure that people around me would say, well, Dave had a good thing going for him, and then he lost it, and he lost his job, and he lost his family, and he lost everything, and so he got drunk. Now, that's what people would say who didn't know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous. What you would say is that I got drunk because I decided to. Because what I've got today is the choice. I've got the choice of whether to drink or whether to not drink. And the only guarantee that I've got is the guarantee that no matter what happens, I don't have to drink. And I think that's the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. I think that when I was growing up, when I started to drink, I had no idea how important booze was. I didn't know then that it was the most important thing in my life, but it was. There's no question about the fact that the most important thing that ever happened to me was booze. And when I started to drink was sometime in high school, probably a little earlier than that. And I don't remember being grabbed by booze. I don't remember that it put on any lights that weren't on before. I don't remember anything dramatic happening, but I remember that little by little, things started to happen that separated me from everybody else. Particularly, I found out that I didn't drink like everybody else drank. And what I found happened is that people would ask me why I drank the way that I did. And I found that I had to begin a lifestyle at that time that got me away from questions that I didn't want to answer. So I found that the best way for me to do that was to drink with you on Monday and with you guys Tuesday and with you Wednesday and you Thursday, so that I didn't run into the situation of everybody seeing how I was every night and asking me a question. Not that I couldn't answer the question myself, I could have. I could have told them anything that I wanted to, but the fact was, I didn't know why. I didn't know why I got drunk last night and the night before and the night before that. I had no idea. And I know that I didn't want anybody to threaten my drinking because it was the most important thing in my life. And as I look back on my life now, every single thing that I did was built around my need to drink and to continue to drink and to continue to have access to booze. Everything that I did. Where I worked, where I went to school, who I hung around with, what I did in my entire life was built around booze. And I know that as I drank, I used to meet two different kinds of people. I'd meet the kinds of people who would say, "Dave, you're drinking a little too much, and maybe you ought to slow down." And I would probably look at what I'd been doing and think, "I've been drinking a little bit too much, maybe I ought to try and slow down." And then I'd meet people who'd say, after something particularly tragic had happened, "Dave, you shouldn't drink." And I didn't understand them at all. What they were saying was that I should give up the only thing that I could count on. No question about the fact that I believed that I couldn't abuse it, but I certainly couldn't give it up. It never made any sense to me that somebody said, "Dave, you shouldn't drink." Because they didn't understand. The people who said, "You're drinking too much," they were probably right, and maybe I should drink a little less. But for the people who said, "Don't drink," I ignored them. So I began a lifestyle that kept me away from everything and everyone that wanted me to slow down and not drink quite as much or to eliminate it altogether. And when I was about 16, I did what every young alcoholic does in order to drink a little bit better. I ran away from home. And it was the kind of situation that wasn't entirely rejected by my family. When I said I was going to run away from home, my mother made me a lunch and my father started the car. And I grew up in a small town in Massachusetts and decided I'd head for the big city and went down to New York. And what I wanted to do was go to sea. I had always heard that on merchant ships, everybody has a good time. And I decided that's what I wanted to do. So I tried to get a job in the port of New York, and I didn't have any luck. And I heard that they were hiring out of Mobile, Alabama. So somehow I got down to Mobile, Alabama. And some things started to happen to me in Mobile that could have told me that booze was going to be a serious influence on my life. I would go up and down the docks and go aboard the ships in the harbor and try and get a job. And usually the ship was going to be gone for 3 years, and I had to be back to school in September. Or they weren't hiring any crew, and day after day it was the same thing. And I was living in the Merchant Seamen's Club in Government Street. And one day I was sitting in the waterfront bar that I went to every night and having a drink. And there was a guy sitting alongside me, and he had a red Van Dyke beard and a big red handlebar mustache and a red crew cut and a very thick guttural German accent. And he said, "What ship are you off?" And of course, I wanted to belong, so I told him I was off a British ship in the harbor and a citizen of the Republic of Ireland. I didn't know at the time those two things didn't go together. And I guess he told me what ship he was off, and we talked for a while, and I don't remember much else. The next thing that I knew, a fellow was shaking me, and he was saying fore and aft, which is a command given on ships when the ship is about to leave the dock. And he was saying fore and aft, and I didn't believe I was on a ship. It was a nightmare, and I turned over, and he picked me up and put me on the deck. And there were 14 smelly bunks in the room and one little round porthole, and I knew I was on a ship. And so I went outside and decided the first thing I'd better do was to find the gangway and get off. So I went over to the port side, and there was no dock there. I went over to the starboard side, and there was no dock there. And there were two tugs on the bow and two on the stern, and we were already at sea. So I went around to the stern of the ship to see where the ship was from, but the ship's flag was down, and I went back to the forecastle head where the crew had gathered, and they were speaking a language that I had never heard before. And I was in a position that is not uncommon to alcoholics. I didn't know where I was going, when I would get back, and I sure in hell wasn't going to ask. So I was pointed to the kind of work that I was going to do, which was that of an ordinary seaman, and I went up to the bow and started stowing the lines. And the ship's cargo holds were closed, and it was the biggest ship I had ever seen in my life. I was used to the little fishing boats off Massachusetts, and this ship was 918 feet long and 116 feet on the beam, and I had no idea where we were going. And by about the second day, I was on the stern of the ship, and I saw some of the ship's papers. And the ship was registered in Monrovia, Liberia, West Africa. So I figured we were going to West Africa. But then as time went by, I could see we were headed for southern oceans, and it turned out that the ship was in ballast, and it was going down to a place called Puerto Rodas, Venezuela, to pick up iron ore, and might or might not come back to the United States. And on the third day at sea, something happened that gave me a clue, or at least after I got to the program, gave me a clue of the kind of life that I was living. Because on the third day at sea, I came down from the forecastle head and I wanted to get a drink of water, and at the top of the ladder was the water fountain, and I started up the ladder to the make deck to get a drink. And when I got my hand on the top rail, there was a boot on it. And I followed the boot up, and there was the guy with the red Van Dyke beard and the red handlebar mustache that I hadn't seen since the bar 3 nights before. And he said, "Where are you going?" And I said, "To get a drink." And he said, "Well, don't bother climbing the ladder. I'll have the steward bring a beer to your forecastle." And he picked up his boot, caught me under the chin, and whipped me off the ladder. And the bosun came down and got me and told me I shouldn't do things like that. But here I was where I wanted to be. I wanted to be on a ship. I wanted to be going to sea. Had no idea how I got there. I found out later that my name was on the articles of shipping, and because it was, I couldn't have been shanghaied. But in fact, if I had known I was going on that ship, I don't know why I didn't go across the street and pick up my gear, which I didn't do, and I spent the next 7 years on merchant ships. And spending the next 7 years on merchant ships gave me an opportunity to continue to go to school, and it gave me an opportunity to get into the National Maritime Union in New York, because I had been shanghaied on what's called a Pimblahanco ship, a foreign flag vessel that was owned by an American company. So I went to the Union Hall on West 17th Street in New York. And you know how an alcoholic's life sometimes turns out pretty good? Mine turned out pretty good. I got a full book in the membership. I got a full book membership in the union in return for telling my story when and where the union wanted it told. And I spent the next 7 years going to sea, essentially when I wanted to go, and working as a bar waiter on passenger ships. So what's wrong with booze? There was nothing wrong with booze. And I know how I got off the ships was a little along the same kind of lines. I was sailing for the Moore McCormick Company, and we were on a trip one time up to the Soviet Union. And on the way back from Russia, we stopped in Gdynia, Poland, and I met some seamen from the same hall on their way north. And they told me about a Farallon Line ship, the Black Swan, that was going to sail from the port of New York the day we got back and circumnavigate Africa. And I had never circumnavigated Africa. And I was a college graduate, but still going to sea and still loving it and still drinking the way that I always had. And so I went into the Merchant Seaman's Hall in Gdynia and wired the United States and was able to obtain a berth on that ship. So a couple of weeks later, when we got into the port of New York, I had about 4 hours to get from Pier 42 down to Pier 48 to get on the ship that was sailing at 5 o'clock that night. And when I got ready to go ashore, the mate called me and he said, "Where are you going?" And I said, "I'm going to Africa." And so he said, "Come on to my cabin, I want to talk to you." So I went up to his cabin and he said, "You've got your college degree now, and don't you think it's time that you went ashore and got a job and gave up the sea? Because if you don't, you never will." And I told him I didn't think he should have an opinion on what I did with my life. And he told me that I shouldn't use the language I had just used, because my father was there, and he opened the door to his forecastle, and my father was there. And I had sent him a letter from Poland and said that I was going to be passing through New York and I'd call them, but my father decided to come down and see me, and so he wanted me to come ashore, and he had talked to somebody that would give me an interview. And my father said, "Why don't you come ashore and we'll have a drink and talk about your future?" And my father said, "Come and have a drink." And I didn't go to Africa. I went ashore and I had a drink with him, and we talked about different things. And the job that he was talking about was that of a traveling salesman. And you know what traveling salesmen do. And you know traveling salesmen have to do a lot of entertaining and they have to do a lot of drinking. And really, the drinking justifies the job and the job justifies the drinking. And if he had said, "Come ashore and be a librarian," I'd have gone to Africa. But knowing that I had a way to justify, not to you, but to justify to me, the way that I needed to drink, I went ashore and took that job. And everything went well for a long time. And by the time I was 26, I had a job where I was assistant to the president of a company listed on the New York Stock Exchange. I had about $2 million in stock options. I had a family. I had everything going really well. And the way that job came to an end is not uncommon for an alcoholic. We were headquartered in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, and it was decided that I should go and visit the dealers. And the dealers stretched from Florida up to Illinois. And my first stop was to be in Central Florida. And the night before I left, my friends decided they'd have a going away party for me. So we had a great party, and the next morning I woke up a little bit late. And by the time I got up to Orlando, It was a little bit too late to call on the dealer. So I decided I'd check into the hotel and see him early in the morning. And after I checked in and on the way to the room, I looked in the bar, and there was a fellow sitting in there all alone. And I didn't think he should be in there alone. So I went in and we had a few drinks together, and the next thing I knew, they were closing the bar. So I went to my room. And the next morning when I woke up, it was about 11 o'clock, and I thought, if I call on the guy in Orlando, I'll be too late to get to Tallahassee, so I better just skip him and go to Tallahassee. And I got to Tallahassee about 5 o'clock, and it was too late to call on the dealer, so I went to the hotel. And I checked in, and on the way to the room, I looked in the bar, and there wasn't anybody there, and I thought I'd have a drink before anybody got in. And when I went to my room, it was about 2 o'clock in the morning, and I overslept the next morning and decided I'd better get on to Alabama. And when I got there, it was too late to call on the dealer, and you know what I did, and you know what happened. And when I got to Memphis, Tennessee, there was a notice there that I had left the company. When I first came into Alcoholics Anonymous, my sponsor, Ken, said to me, "Did you ever lose a job because of alcoholism?" And I said, "No." You know, I thought that I lost that job because I left too late on the first day. After I lost that job, I got into Washington, D.C., and I got a job in Washington working on a linen truck, and everything was going just fine. And then a little while later, they said, "You shouldn't drive the linen truck. You can ride in the back." And while all that was going on, the company that I had originally worked for got in touch with me and said, "We need a man in New York. Would you go to New York? I'm working on a linen truck. They want me to go to New York where I get a car, $25,000 a year salary, and a house to live in." And I said, "Okay." What's wrong with drinking? My life tended to continue to work out, and I went to New York, and we had a nice home in Long Island. But as alcoholism starts to go downhill, at least as it did with me, when it starts to go downhill, it went downhill awfully quickly, and things that were happening to me then, I didn't want to have happen. I couldn't prevent from happening, and I couldn't predict that they would happen, and I couldn't predict the results. There are things that happened to me in the last couple of years of drinking that I never want to forget, and perhaps the most important of those happened when I was living in Long Island. And my son was born in Plainview, New York. My wife was home from the hospital about 6 weeks, and one night decided she wanted to go and visit friends or go to the hairdresser or something. I don't remember. What I do remember and what's important was that I had agreed that I would take care of the baby. And of course, that's what I intended to do. And I don't know what happened that night. I do know that when my wife came home and opened the door and walked into the living room, that I was unconscious in a chair in the living room with my feet up on the hassock, and apparently the baby had awakened, or I went to get him to play with him or something, and I brought him out, and the baby had apparently been between my legs, and when I passed out, he slipped through my legs, and my knees closed on his ankles, and his head was dangling about that far off the ground when she came in. And she picked him up and ran into the bedroom and called an ambulance and put the bureau up against the door so that I couldn't get in. And I knew what I had done, and I knew that my son might be brain damaged or dead or anything like that. And I passed out in the chair again, and I remembered them leaving the house, and I passed out again, and I came to about 4 o'clock in the morning. And the guilt and the remorse that many of you are familiar with impacted on me like a ton of bricks. What I had done to my son the night before, and what I had done to him because I was drinking. And I did the only thing that I think an alcoholic knows how to do, or at least the only thing I knew how to do. I went into the kitchen and made a drink. Because there isn't any way to live with that sort of thing. And I was talking to Vince tonight about that same son who is now applying to Notre Dame Law School and who is doing just great and who survived that through no fault of mine. He survived that through the grace of God. And he survived that through the kind of situation that sometimes alcoholics go through, and sometimes alcoholics get away with, and sometimes they don't. And I got transferred out here to California in 1968. And I was living in a hotel in West Los Angeles. And things were really going badly. But the one thing that I could always count on was booze. And when it started to not work terribly, I had to count on it more. And in June, in early June of 1968, I was out with some customers, and as usual at lunch, the waitress came by and said, "What'll you have?" And I said, "A martini." And she said, "Not today, it's election day." I said, "No big deal." And I left the restaurant. And I got in my car to go back to the hotel in West Los Angeles because I had a bottle in the room. And I had to get back to the bottle, and that ride back from somewhere in the foothills, I don't know today where it was, that ride was absolutely insane. I pulled off the road, and I guess I pulled into a shopping center, and I don't remember much about that, but what I do remember is a very elderly man was shaking me. I was apparently trying to get the door of a bar open, and his eyes were full of fear, and he was saying, "Don't you understand, it's closed." And I got back in the car, and I finally got back to the hotel, and I walked into the hotel room, and for those of you who are new to the program, you probably understand this. I walked into the room, and I didn't run over to the bottle. I walked into the room, and I saw the bottle sitting there, and I was all right. And in a moment, I went over and had a drink. But to know that it was there, to know that it was all right, to know that I could have a drink, was the answer to the problem that I had that day. And I knew that the problem wasn't the fact that I didn't have a drink. The problem was that I hadn't planned for it. If I'd had it in the car, if I'd had it with me, I wouldn't have gone through all that terror or all that fear. Because the problem, as I could see it, was not with not drinking. Or was not with drinking. The problem was with not drinking. I knew what would happen if I drank. I didn't have any idea what would happen if I didn't drink, and what I thought it would be a continuation of what I saw that day. And after a few days, when I couldn't get into an elevator, and I couldn't go downstairs, and I couldn't drink, and I couldn't not drink, I was out for a walk one morning, and I went by a church, and I said, "That's it, I need to go to confession." And I went in to see the priest, and I talked to him for about an hour. And he said, "Well, I'll be happy to hear your confession, but I don't think that's your problem." He said, "I think your problem is booze." And I said, "I don't think you were listening. I'll tell you again." And he said, "No, I think your problem is booze, and there's a man in the parish who knows something about alcoholism, and if you like, I'll get him on the phone." And I said, "No, thank you." So he called him. And he got this guy on the phone, and the guy said, "Dave, I've heard what you're going through," and he said, "I know you're having a terrible time, and I think I know what your problem is. My name is Ken, and I'm an alcoholic." And I thought, gee, with all the problems I had, I didn't know what I could do for him. I didn't know why he was telling me such a thing. I hope nobody heard him. And he said that if I wanted him to, he'd come over to the hotel room. And I said, "No, thank you." And a little while later, he showed up at the hotel. And he walked into the room, and many of you know Ken S., he walked into the room, and the room was an absolute pig pen. It was a terrible room. There was a print on the wall of a Mexican on a burro, and at night he'd get off the burro and chase me around the room, and the room was a shambles. And Ken took all the clothes that were on the chair, threw them on the floor, and sat down, and he didn't talk to me about me. As I thought that he would. He started to talk to me about himself, and he told me how he flew a plane into the side of a mountain during the Berlin airlift and killed 8 people aboard, and he told me how he continued to drink after that. And he told me about fear and loneliness and hate and anxiety and all the kinds of things that I never thought that a man would tell another man. And he told me that he had found a program called Alcoholics Anonymous and that he was an alcoholic, and then he told me what I thought was the first lie of the day. He told me that he hadn't had a drink in 3 years. And he told me there was a meeting that very night, which I thought was a coincidence. And he told me that if I wanted to go, he would take me, and you know what I said, and you know what he said. And so we went to the Monday night meeting in Ohio Street on the 10th of June, 1968, walked into the back of the room. I took a chair in the back, and he picked me up and took me to the front of the room. And I was sitting on my hands, and when they asked for newcomers, somebody on either side pulled my hands out. And I raised my hands, and I could not believe what was going on there that night. I could not believe that the first person who got up and said that they were an alcoholic was a very, very pretty girl. And the next man who got up talked and said that he was an alcoholic. And I couldn't believe people were talking like this. And people came up and said things to me like, "Have a cookie," or "Have a piece of cake." And My life was a shambles and they were offering cake. And what they said that night, I needed to know 11 years later when I was living in that room in Balboa Island. They said, "You don't have to take another drink." Ken told me that if I wanted to drink, I could. But he said I didn't have to take another drink. And on that Wednesday night, or Thursday night, we went to a meeting in Santa Monica. And I met Clint at that meeting and a few other people that are in this room. And at that meeting, things were going very badly for me. And I remember there were two groups. And one group, after the meeting, they would get together and decide whether I should go to a hospital or not. One group felt that I should cold turkey it, and the other group felt I should go to the hospital. And any time I got up to say anything, both groups would say, "Sit down and have a cookie." And I didn't get to say anything, but the group that felt that I shouldn't go to the hospital won. And I went back to the hotel room, and the next day things really went badly. And so I called Ken, and his wife was in Al-Anon, Agnes, and she said, "You better come to the house." So I went to the house where they were going to call for a doctor. And when I got to the house, I was scared to death. And the first thing that Agnes said was, "Well, you better loosen your collar or I might have to get to your tongue." And then invited me in the house, and I don't remember very much about the next several days except the children. I didn't want the children to know that I was an alcoholic. I didn't want them to know that their father had met me in a place like Alcoholics Anonymous. Neither did I know that they were an Alateen. And I found out a little bit more about them and how they felt about this whole thing by the way they treated me. One day Paul came home from school before his brother Chris. Chris met him at the door and he said, "Hey, Mr. Collins had some beef stew today." And they talked about me with the kind of love and feeling and compassion that I certainly didn't have for myself. And Judy, a pretty little blue-eyed blonde who was just absolutely fabulous to me, she came home one day and said, "How do you feel today?" And I said, "Well, the cramps are a little less. They're in my thighs." And she said, "Pretty soon they'll be in your ankles." And I mean, these kids talked to me in a way that I couldn't imagine kids understood how I felt or could care about me as they did. And so my story in Alcoholics Anonymous was a story of meeting somebody at the very first meeting who told me that the only excuse I had for missing a meeting was because I died on the way. Who didn't tell me anything at all about how to choose a sponsor. Instead, he said, "I'm your sponsor." And who took the time with me to teach me what the steps meant. And what the steps meant was that if I wanted to drink, I could. And if I didn't want to drink, I had the opportunity through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous to not drink again a day at a time. And I remember I said to Ken on the way to a meeting one time, I said, "What about my daughter's wedding?" And he said, "No, you won't be able to drink at your daughter's wedding." We drove a little further, and then he asked what I thought was an unusual question. He said, "How old is she?" And I said, 4. The idea of living a day at a time or doing things a day at a time was beyond any comprehension that I had. And going to a meeting every day and learning to go out and learning to do things that I had never been able to do without booze, I was very afraid, and I was afraid of what would happen if I left Ken, and I was afraid of what would happen if I left the group. I was afraid of everything. And I was sober about 9 months, and I had to go out of town on a business trip. And the trip was going to take place the next month. And so I started talking to Ken and all my friends about what am I going to do going out of town, and I'm not sure I should go, and I don't think I'm ready for it. And they told me there was Alcoholics Anonymous in Detroit, and I could go to a meeting in Detroit. And I said, "Well, I don't know if I'll be able to find the meeting." And he said, "Well, get in touch with AA in Detroit, and they'll let you know." So I wrote to the Alcoholics Anonymous Central Office in Detroit, said that I was coming to town, and I'd like to go to a meeting. So they sent me a directory. And I looked at the directory, and I thought, "I don't know Detroit." So I wrote back and I said, "Could you circle a couple of meetings that are near this hotel?" So they sent back another directory and they circled a couple of meetings that were near the hotel. And then I thought, "What if I get in at 10 o'clock? So I wrote back to them and I said, "In case I get in a little bit late, could you give me the names and phone numbers of a couple of people?" And they called back and they said, "What flight? We'll meet the plane." And when I got off the plane, there was an American Airlines ramp mechanic standing there as I came off with about 80 other people, and he stopped me and he said, "Are you Dave?" And I said, "How did you know?" And he took me to an AA meeting at the airport that night. And I began to learn that I could do anything that I wanted to do, that I could go anywhere that I wanted to go, and I could find AA any place in the world, and that no matter what happened, I didn't have to drink. And as my life changed and as my business changed, I began to do business in different parts of the world, and particularly a lot of business outside the United States. And it used to be great fun to go to meetings and be the guy from out of town. And one time I was in a little town, a little Saudi town in the Gulf of Arabia, and I found out that there was a meeting in a hospital in the town, and I decided I'd go. And I walked into this meeting, and I found an Omani and a Yemeni and a couple of Germans and an Englishman and an Indian. So I thought, I'm really the guy from out of town. And I walked in and I said, "Hi, my name is Dave. I'm an alcoholic. I'm from California." And the Yemeni looked up and said, "No kidding. Do you know Clancy?" I said, "Who?" And about 4 years ago, when we got married, we were flying down to, we had the great good fortune to be able to go to New Zealand on our honeymoon. And the Air New Zealand flight made a stop in Honolulu, and they changed crews. And a new crew got on, and we took off. And we were about an hour out of Honolulu on the way to Fiji. And the purser stopped by, and we kind of looked at each other. And then he asked me my name, and I told him, and his name was Russ, and many of you know him from this meeting, and he and I had met when he was in his first week or two of sobriety. And so we went with him to his home in Auckland, and we went to the yard in Auckland, and I told my wife about this meeting and about Clancy and so on. And a couple of weeks ago, we were down in South Africa, and we were visiting some family of my wife's in South Africa, and we were on the border of Mozambique, and somebody came in with a newspaper from Johannesburg, and I hadn't seen the newspaper in a few days, and I started to read it, and on the front page is the name Clancy I. On the front page of the Johannesburg newspaper, in a story about the Midnight Mission in Los Angeles. So when I got back, I dropped Clancy a note, sent him the clipping, and I told him a very important truism, that day I had been in Costa Mesa, and I met a guy, and I said, "Do you know Clancy?" And he said, "No." Since I've come to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, the most important lesson that I've learned, the most important thing that I know, is that I don't have to drink. And when things went terribly upside down about 10 years ago, it was the one thing that I absolutely knew. As bad as it was, as bad as it could get, as good as it was and as good as it could get, I didn't have to drink. It is absolutely the most important piece of knowledge I have about my life today, and it's because of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. There's a story about Marty who walked into the sanitarium in Connecticut after visiting the very first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting in New York in 1938. And the people who lived in that particular home were very anxious for Marty to come back because they wanted to know what she had found. They had tried for years to find some way to deal with this problem that they had. They had never been able to find a way. So when they learned about this thing in New York called Alcoholics Anonymous, they asked Marty to go. So Marty went, and she came back the next day, and she walked into the living room, and she looked at everybody in the room, and she said, "We're not alone anymore." And that's how I feel about Alcoholics Anonymous. That's how I feel that no matter what happens to me, no matter what happened 11 years ago, I was never alone. One time I was in Bangkok, and I had to catch a flight to go to Rome. And I didn't have a reservation. And so I went out to the airport and I waited, and a flight came in from the Malaysian Airlines service, and there was one seat on the 747, and so I took the seat. And we took off, and the first stop was to be in Kabul about 8 hours later, and so I went to sleep, and A little while later, a stewardess came through and woke me up with tea and handed me a note. And I thought the note was from her. It wasn't. The note was from the pilot. And the note said, "Saw you at a meeting in Singapore last week. Come on up and have some coffee." And I'm not alone anymore. The program has given me everything that I have, but most importantly, it's given me the knowledge that no matter what happens, I don't have to take another drink. And for that, I'm very grateful. Thank you.